Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content. They may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Union Station was busy as always. The large train station had become the busiest train station in the Midwest, and today was one of the more busier days. It was 11 o'clock in the morning, and the bright sun was beaming through the glass roof that was above them. Jack stood with his back to the main train car and was facing his mother and his father. His father was a spitting image of Jack, and the two held a special bond ever since childhood. Jack's mother was a quiet woman, and even now was reserving her emotions until Jack had officially boarded the train. As a large crowd of people all huddled around the train, several people were bumping into the three individuals, but they didn't seem to care. Jack's mother went to take a picture with her brand new camera that she spent a fortune to buy for this occasion. "Mom, please, not another picture," Jack said, waving his hand in front of his dimpled smile. "Jack, just let her take the picture. You're only making the pain last longer," Jack's father said. "Okay, all right, but I'm not gonna like it, though," Jack said as he stood up straight and gave his best military stance. "That's okay, you don't have to like it. You just have to look like you do, or I'll make you take another one," his mom said, taking a picture of Jack. "See? Was it that hard?" his dad muttered. "I guess not," Jack said just before the final call for boarding was made.
"All aboard, truck 34!
Yelled one man standing close to Jack and his parents. "All right, Jack, you better get on that train, or your fiance's gonna wonder what happened to you," Jack's father said. "Yes, please tell her we said hello. I hope her mom is recovering," Jack's mom expressed as her eyes began to wallow up with tears.
"I will, Mom, don't worry. Jesus Christ, Mom, don't start crying now," Jack said as he leaned in and hugged his mom.
What Jack's mom didn't see was Jack was struggling not to cry himself.
"Now don't you start cussing like a sailor and misusing the Lord's name,"
his mom jokingly scolded as she took out a tissue and wiped the tears from her eyes.
"Don't worry, Mom. I won't," Jack said with a smile on his face.
When Jack looked over at his dad, he fought the urge to burst out in tears. His father had never looked at him with such pride as he had in this moment. However, Jack could see that there was also fear in his father's eyes. The only thing that had given his father any comfort was knowing that his son was not going to be an infantryman, fighting in the trenches like he had 20 years earlier. But, as he often reminded Jack, war is still war, regardless of how you fight it. Jack leaned in and gave his father a big bear hug before he said one more final goodbye to them and made his way towards the train. Once he was inside, there was only two seats available left in the car. Jack headed to the first one, which was an aisle seat facing the back of the train. The man who he was going to sit next to was wearing the same black and white striped dress shirt and black dress pants as he was. The only difference was Jack was wearing a gray suit jacket and the other man was wearing a black one. Jack threw his bag in front of the seat and proceeded to look out the window to his right to see if he could still see his mom and his dad, which he could. His heart broke when he looked out and saw his mom sobbing uncontrollably. That was when he heard a voice call out,
"You gonna sit?"
Jack stopped and looked down at where the voice came from. It was from the man sitting next to him with a matching shirt. The man was reading a book and didn't make eye contact with Jack, but instead kept his eyes glued to the book. "Excuse me?" Jack asked. Looking up from the book, he said,
"Are you gonna sit down?"
"I will in a moment," Jack said, looking at his parents.
"Girlfriend?"
the man asked, keeping his eyes glued to the book.
"No, parents," Jack responded.
"Where are you headed?"
the man asked. Jack turned around, facing the man, and replied,
"Pittsburgh. I'm spending the evening with my fiance before catching the train in North Carolina for basic training."
"Oh, what branch?"
the man asked. At this time, the train began slowly moving.
"Air Corps,"
Jack responded, watching his parents slowly drift away.
"You and me both,"
the man responded. Jack held off his response until his parents had disappeared out of sight, and then he sat down.
"Is that so?"
replied Jack.
"Yep,
I'm going to be a pilot, the man softly said, putting his book in his lap and extended his hand to Jack. As Jack lifted up his hand to shake the man's hand, the man introduced himself. David Booker. My friends call me Tango. Jack Miller. Why do they call you Tango? Jack asked. It's a long story that revolves a long night of drinking. I'll tell you when I know you better, Tango responded. Oh, okay. You from here? Asked Jack. Yeah, you? Questioned Tango. Yep, in the Clayton area. Alexander Drive, just behind the library, Jack responded. No shit. I live not too far from there, Pershing Avenue, by the railroad tracks, Tango explained. What school did you go to? Jack asked. Soldin. Soldin? I was on the football team at Clayton. You guys were always our first game of the season. I was on the basketball team in Soldin. We hated playing Clayton. Well, we never minded playing y'all. It was always an easy win for us. Tango laughed to himself, and then he sat forward and grabbed a flask out of his bag and then handed it to Jack and said, Here's to old rivals. Jack smiled, opening the flask up and took a sip from it and then handed it back to Tango. Jack then looked up and said, I'd say this is off to a good start. One year later, April 6th, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0441. Beans was sitting at one of the tables in the enlisted men mess halls. Sitting with him was Willie, Tommy, Pally, and oddly enough, Cecil Jones. Cecil had become quite friendly with the men of Loaded Bull, and he fit in like he was one of the original crew members. The topic that morning as the men gagged down their breakfast was the swarm of new crews and new faces that filled the mess hall. In the last week, over a dozen air crews and new B-17s landed in Thurlow to replenish the numbers lost. Out of the 12 new crews, four of them were just for the 530th Squadron. None of the boys from Loaded Bull bothered to learn their names or find out who they were. What was the point? Men like Cecil were worried that there were too many rookies flying today's mission, but at the same time, it wasn't like the upper brass had much of an option. A month ago today, the roster for their 530th Squadron read, St. Lunatic, flown by Major Anthony Griffith. Hailing Mary, flown by Lieutenant Brolin. Hellfire from Above, flown by Lieutenant White. Georgia Bell, flown by Lieutenant Clyde Duke. Cap'n Kids, flown by Lieutenant Bernhausen. Bomb McGee, flown by Lieutenant Richard Leslie. Chief, flown by Captain Robert Dearborn. Loaded Bull, flown by Lieutenant Anthony Backus. Of those eight planes, only five remained. St. Lunatic was shot up on the Berlin mission and was still reported missing in action. Georgia Bell crashed coming back from Frankfurt a week ago, and Chief was shot down on that same mission. The 530th Squadron still hadn't fully recovered from the numbers lost during Big Week back in February. A squadron, normally, would have anywhere between 12 and 15 planes on its roster. However, for the last month, the 530th Squadron had a grand total of 8 to 9 planes on its roster. Now with the new crews, the 530th finally had 12 planes on its roster sheet. Squadrons like the 529th Squadron and 531st Squadron were still low on planes, and many crews in the 530th were required to fly backup in those weakened squadrons.
All these fucking rookies. You know we're going to be going somewhere easy today.
Willie commented. I hate to agree with you, but I think you're right. I don't see us going anywhere tough with so many greenies. Beans replied. I mean, look at this guy over here. Doesn't that guy look like he's fucking 50 years old? You're telling me that that guy's eligible to fly? Willie said, pointing to an airman who was sitting with his rookie crew at the table across from them. He does look rather old, Pally commented. I'm telling you, these new guys, they get uglier and uglier every fucking day. Just as Beans was going to respond, the boss and Jack arrived at the boys' table. Ayo! Tommy called out. Hey, what's up, boss? Beans asked the two officers. Nothing much. Just checking up on you boys to see how you're doing. Hey, I don't think I recognize you, the boss said, looking at Cecil, who was sitting between Pally and Beans. Boss, that's Cecil. He flew with us on our last mission. He was our radio guy, said Pally. Oh, that's right. Sorry, I didn't recognize you, the boss said. Looking around the room, Jack saw that there were a lot of new faces. He looked at the boss and said, Look, they have just as many new people here as they did in ours. I can't believe they're letting that many new people fly today. Well, let's hope that we don't get all split up today. Don't want to be fighting Jerry's with greenies next to us, Beans commented. I hear ya. Well, I'll see you boys on the flight line, okay? Sound good? The boss asked. Yes, sure, Willie said back, saluting the boss with a full mouth of food. The boss and Jack both walked away from the table and headed to their briefings. An hour later, Willie, Tommy, Beans, Pally, Cecil, and Alex were waiting by a troop truck that was ready to take them to their plane. The boys learned that the mission set for them today was to bomb a U-boat base in Brest, France. This was another target that the 300th had bombed a half dozen times since last fall, but due to cloud cover and the U-boat base being covered in a thick layer of concrete of which the heaviest bombs couldn't break through, the 300th was set to bomb it again. The formation was set to fly at a low 18,000 feet, and this was to ensure accurate bombing as well as fly under the high-altitude clouds, which were set to be around 20,000 to 21,000 feet. The formation that day was going to be small, only consisting of three groups, 160 aircraft total, a long way from the 800-plus planes that flew over Berlin a month ago. The mission, however, wasn't a total suicide mission, for a much larger bomber force, mainly consisting of B-24s, would be flying to bomb a large U-boat pen in Lorient, about 70 miles down the western coast of France. It was calculated that the larger force would be flying ahead of the Brest force and would therefore take most of the fighter opposition in the area. The 300th and the rest of the group was expected to face heavy flak but light fighters, so overall, the 300th felt like they could catch a break today. The only men who seemed to be in the mood to talk that morning were Willie and Tommy. Beans listened along with Cecil, but Alex sat by himself at the head of the truck bed, looking off in distance like a man lost in a trance. The boss and Jack arrived, but not with Rosie or Andy. Instead, in their place, was a tall blonde man and a skinny, long-faced man with dark hair. The boss introduced them as Second Lieutenant Charlie Swindle, a rookie navigator, and Second Lieutenant Oliver Penn, an experienced bombardier. "Where's Rosie and Andy?" asked Willie. Rosie and Andy are flying with two new crews, you know, to put some experienced members in the mix. In fact, I think Andy's flying in your place, right, Charlie? The boss asked. Yep, that's right, Charlie confirmed. Where are you from? Tommy asked. Seattle, Charlie answered. An overwhelming feeling of grief fell upon Tommy, for he was reminded of Al, since he too was from Seattle. Tommy couldn't remember the last time he or anyone of the crew spoke a word about Al. It seemed like a lifetime ago since he'd passed. Tommy then got the sense that Beans and Willie were feeling the same way since their demeanor changed as well. What about you? Willie asked Oliver. Butler, Pennsylvania. Butler? Isn't that near Pittsburgh? Jack asked. Yeah, real close. You familiar? Oliver asked. I went to school in Pittsburgh. My roommate was from Butler, Jack responded. No shit. I haven't met anyone from Butler. What was his name? Oliver asked. William McCall, Jack responded. No, I'm sorry, not ringing any bells. Small world, though, Oliver replied before he threw his bag in the back of the troop truck. All right, enough with the chit-chat, men. We can continue this on the way to the plane. We've got 28 minutes until takeoff, the boss replied as he put his things in the back of the troop truck as well. One by one,
The men all got inside the troop truck, and soon, the men were all headed towards their hard stand. Once the men arrived at the bull, the men all got up out of the troop truck and proceeded to head to their stations. While on his way, the boss stopped and looked up at the 5 yellow-painted bombs, which were located above the navigator's window on the left side, just behind the left cheek gun window, showing the amount of successful missions Loaded Bull had flown. Under the left cheek gun window were 3 small white German swastikas, showing the number of downed Nazi planes that were confirmed. As the boss took in the achievements, he heard Jack say to him,
"Number 6, can you believe it?"
The boss looked behind him and saw Jack approaching him. The boss then looked back at the bull and said,
"6, is that all?"
"Well, if we survive today, it will be 6, Jack said. "Why does it feel like it should be more than that?" the boss asked.
"Well, technically, I've flown 6, but after today, hopefully, it will be 7. You're the same way, no?"
Jack said. The boss nodded his head.
"Hey, no more talking about how many missions and if we're going to make it back or not. Jesus Christ, you guys are going to jinx us!"
Oliver yelled as he was about to enter into the nose compartment hatch.
"You superstitious, Oliver?" asked Jack with a smile upon his face. "I don't know how you can't be,"
Oliver said, allowing the nervous Charlie to enter first.
"I've got God on my side,"
Jack said, walking up to the bull.
"Well, don't get me wrong. I was raised Catholic. I believe in God. But I've got all my bases covered,"
Oliver said, opening up his jacket to reveal a rabbit's foot, Jewish star, Christian cross, and an Egyptian ankh hanging off his necklace.
"How many missions have you flown?"
asked Jack, looking rather stunned by Oliver's collection.
12. Why?"
Oliver asked.
"So, today would be your 13th mission, yes?"
Jack said. Willie, who was about to enter into the nose hatch, went from looking at Jack and then looked at Oliver and saw his face turn white. Willie cocked a smile and then patted the lieutenant on his shoulder before entering the plane.
"Lucky 13, Willie said. "I wouldn't worry about it, buddy. You'll be all right," Jack said, walking up to the nose hatch.
Oliver, looking concerned still and scared, said,
"I've got to piss on a wheel."
"You what?" the boss asked.
"I've got to piss on a wheel,"
Oliver replied, walking up to the left side wheel underneath the number 2 engine.
"What the hell is that going to do, except dry out my tire?" "It's for good luck, trust me,"
Oliver said, moving his parachute strap out from between his legs and unzipped his pants to urinate on the wheel. Jack and the boss both gave each other a humorous look, and then Jack asked, "Did I scare him too much?"
"Maybe.
It's entertaining, though," the boss said, watching Oliver try to force himself to pee. Then, Charlie exited the hatch, and when the boss asked him what he was doing, the rookie navigator responded with,
"Can't be too sure,"
before he went over to the wheel and tried urinating on it, too. Both Jack and the boss laughed to one another before the boss entered into the nose hatch and made his way into the cockpit, and Jack threw his bags inside the hatch and proceeded to do the external pre-flight checks. As Jack looked over the outside of the bull, he looked over the left side waist compartment, and he heard a voice call out from behind him.
"Hey, bud, you got a light?"
Jack turned around to see an officer dressed in his flight clothes. He had longer black hair, which was combed underneath his brand new officer's hat. He had pale skin, high cheekbones, and thin lips. Jack couldn't believe who he was looking at. He knew him. The man looked at Jack, and his eyes widened, almost out of disbelief.
"Jack?"
asked the man.
"Tango?"
Jack asked.
"Holy shit! What are the odds of this?"
Tango said, walking up to Jack, still looking visibly shocked.
"I can't believe what I'm seeing. When did you get in?"
Jack asked.
"We just flew in a few days ago. We got stuck crossing the channel. How long have you been here? Is this your plane?"
Tango asked.
"It is. We've been here for about a month. Which plane are you in?"
Jack asked.
"That one there. It's called Bad Penny,"
Tango said, pointing to an olive drab painted B-17 parked at Hardstand 35, which was about 70 yards away.
"Bad Penny. Hey, guys, this guy named his plane Bad Penny. How about that?"
Jack said, turning around to face Charlie and Oliver, who were still trying to pee on the tire.
"What? You're asking for bad luck, pal,"
yelled out Oliver.
"Is that your crew?"
Tango asked. "No, those are both replacements subbing in for my Bombardier Navigator. I wish we had more time to catch up," Jack said, looking at his friend from head to toe.
How about we catch up over a beer at the Officers Club, or maybe you can show me around Haverhill? Tango said.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. But oh, yeah, a light. Here you go.
Jack said, reaching into his pocket and grabbing a gold Zippo lighter and helped Tango light up a cigarette.
Thanks, buddy, Tango replied. Absolutely. I'll see you up there, okay? Take care of yourself, Jack said as he began walking back to his plane.
Tango agreed, and he too went back to his plane. Within 30 minutes, Jack and the rest of Loaded Bull would be roaring down the runway and on their way to France.
Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them, they're sponsoring us, so I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where three hosts, a theater director, a movie critic, and a veteran, come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable, and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close, check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Canto 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast.
The formation had just arrived at the decision point, which was 18,000 feet above the French coastal island, Oessent. The formation was to turn to the south and fly for another 5 minutes before turning to their left and heading in for the target. The trip so far had been a dream. Since the flight path mostly followed Britain's southern coast, the men didn't have to get to their stations until almost 3.5 hours after they took off. Men like Tommy enjoyed every minute he could before he had to get inside of his ball turret. He was delighted to sit and eat morning rations and play endless games of tic-tac-toe with men like Cecil in the radio compartment. Now, Tommy was in the ball turret and was now scanning the sky for incoming fighters. The 300th was leading the 3rd group in the back of the formation, and leading the 300th and the rest of the 3rd group was 1st Lieutenant Sean Bernhausen and his crew of Captain Kids. Men like the boss saw this as the brass's way of seeing the potential of other officers at leading in case the current squadron commander didn't work out. Captain Kids was flying rather sloppy, at least by comparison to how Texas flew. He wasn't as stiff and tight in keeping formation, especially in tight formation. He tended to bob up and down like a boat on rough waves. His B-17 had undergone extensive repairs and was up in the air for the first time since Saint-Nazaire. Flying off to Captain Kid's right, the number 2 spot, was the boss and the rest of Loaded Bull. Across from them, on the other side of Captain Kid's, was a rookie crew in a brand new plane called Stormy Knight. Stormy Knight was flown by 2nd Lieutenant Ernest Burkett, a cattle rancher from Great Falls, Montana. Flying between and under Captain Kid's and Loaded Bull, in the number 4 spot, was Bad Penny, which was flown by Jack's friend, 2nd Lieutenant David Tango Booker. Flying off Tango's right side in the number 5 spot was another rookie crew, Stinker Tinker, which was flown by the loud, obnoxious, and bombastic former cigar shop owner, 38-year-old Cedric Effer of Fort Smith, Arkansas. And finally, flying off Tango's left side in the number 6 spot
was the brand new plane named Desperate Journey, flown by rookie pilot Second Lieutenant Clive Ritz of Littleton, Colorado, a subsection of Denver. Beans was at the gunner station and kept looking over at Alex, who left his guns hanging and was just staring out his gunner's opening. From where Alex stood, he could see the 529 squadron flying down the low squadron. Leading the 529 squadron was the Green Dragon, which had been credited with 19 missions, three more since Berlin. The Green Dragon's impressive paint scheme had become iconic with some of the new crews coming in. One crew who was inspired by the Green Dragon's nose art was a crew of Desperate Journey, who painted a long golden ribbon along the left side of the bomber, which told the story of the crew, as they told it, having Savannah, Georgia at one end of the ribbon and the United States at the other end. The idea was that each location the crew would fly to, whether on a mission or to an airfield, the crew would add the location to the ribbon, thus leaving a reminder of all the places the plane had traveled to during its time in war.
Navigator to pilot, we're at the IP. Your new heading is 080. Again, that's 080. Roger that. All right, men, we're on the bomb run. Hold on tight. This could get bad.
The boss called over the intercom. All around the plane, men were putting on their flak vests and helmets, preparing themselves for low-altitude flak barrages, the worst kind of flak since it was more accurate. As the plane turned and banked to the left, Jack looked down at the left-side cockpit window and saw the rest of the small islands of the French coast drifting by below them. Then, just as the formation leveled off and headed towards the target, the flak begun.
Flak, 12 o'clock high,
called in Charlie.
Here we go, boys,
said Jack.
Bomb doors opening,
Oliver called out, setting the bomb bay door lever forward. The familiar sound of air rushing in through the open cavity of the bomber began to roar throughout the plane, and men like Cecil and Alex knew the sound all too well, for it told them that they were more than halfway through completing one more mission. To men like Beans, it only meant that hell was about to be unleashed, and it was not a calming, soothing, or a rewarding sound. Within seconds, the flak began picking up. A flak shell exploded right in front of the bull, sending shrapnel towards the nose compartment. Most of the fragments bounced off the plane, but two small holes were punched above the nose cone. In the top turret, Wooly watched as the flak shell exploded underneath the B-17 flying in the 100th Bombardment Group. The flak shell tore into the plane's left side fuel tanks, causing flames to engulf the left wing and fuselage.
B-17 from the 100th going down. Beans, watch out for Sheech,
Wooly called in.
I'm on it,
Bean said, watching the burning fortress plummet towards Earth as the pilot and crew attempted to bail out through the loaded bomb bay. Only three people were able to get out before the fire detonated all eight 1,000-pound general-purpose demolition bombs stored up inside. While Beans was focused on that, Jack called in.
B-17 from Group 2 going down. Lost his tail. I got it,
Cecil replied. Just then, Cecil heard a call come over the main line. He listened to it and then called in over the intercom.
Radio to pilot, King 1 is calling for altitude change from 18,000 to 19,000 angels. Roger that,
the boss replied, rolling his eyes.
They can't do that, can they?
Jack asked over the intercom.
Not if you're trying to accurately bomb a target, you can't,
Oliver replied.
Well, if we're not shooting for fucking accuracy, then what the hell is the point of flying low to begin with?
Wooly thundered.
Cut the chatter, man. Let's stay focused,
the boss said over the intercom. Just then, Beans in the waste compartment was knocked down when a flak shell went off right next to a station. The blast sent Beans to the floor, and Alex went to Beans' aid. Beans wasn't hit, but small flak holes littered his side of the waste compartment. As Alex helped Beans get back up, Jack asked if everyone was alright, and one by one, men from all over the plane called back in they were okay, including Beans. As Beans arrived back at his gunner station, a large explosion erupted in the radio room, causing Beans to lose his hearing for a moment. Once Beans gathered himself, he looked into the radio room and saw fire billowing from the radio compartment. Both Alex and Beans called in the fire in the radio room, and Beans went to take care of it. And Beans, not having enough time to unplug everything, took off his helmet, threw off his headphones, and took his oxygen mask off and quickly made his way into the radio room. Once in there, Beans was overtaken by what he was seeing. Next to the radio desk was a large basketball-sized hole. Due to the fire and the smoke, Beans couldn't see Cecil sitting at his desk, but he didn't have enough time to look around and examine the area, but instead went back into the waste compartment next to the ball turret, grabbed the fire extinguisher, and began spraying the sections of the radio compartment that were ablaze. As he did, Alex checked Tommy in the ball turret to make sure he was still alive, which he was. Once Beans finished up putting the fire out, he realized why he didn't see Cecil sitting at his radio desk. All that was left of Cecil were both of his severed legs and his lower section of his waist. The rest of his body covered the walls, floor, and ceiling of the radio room. Willie, who had since gotten out of his top turret, was in the open bomb bay and also witnessed the horrific sight. Looking up, Willie could see Bean's stunned face, and soon, Alex too was sent into shock from the image as well.
"Beach! Beach!"
Willie yelled out. It took several attempts for Willie to get Beans' attention, but once he did, he told him to go back to his station and go back on oxygen. Beans, who was now trembling, returned back to his gunner station, with Alex following behind. As he did, Willie informed the boss and the others of what had just happened. Beans returned to his gunner station. His hands were shaking so bad that he could barely put on his oxygen mask, as well as put on his headphones and helmet. Once his headphones were back on, he heard the words,
"Bombs away!"
come from Oliver, and within a few seconds, the bull lifted up from the sudden change of weight, and the call was followed by,
"Bomb doors closing!"
Beans attempted to try a look down and catch a glimpse of the target that would be floating by below them, as the formation banked to the left and was now heading towards the rally point. As he tried, another flak shell exploded to the left side of the bull. Beans was thrown into the side of the waste compartment, and once he gathered himself, he looked over to see Alex lying on the floor of the bomber with his left side blown open. Alex's eyes were both open wide. Terror and fear were now visible on them as he tried to capture his breath.
"Alex is hit! Alex is hit!"
Beans called in as he went to tend to him. As Beans knelt down on the now blood-soaked floor of the bomber next to Alex, he attempted to locate the injury. Taking his gloves off to get a better grip, he noticed that Alex was gasping for air and his face was quickly turning white. His eyes were locked on to Beans, almost his nonverbal way of calling out for help. Using his bare hands to undo Alex's flak vest, Beans then looked at Alex's side and was confused by what he was seeing. Pieces of his intestines and other organs were spilling out or hanging out, and that was when Bean realized that the flak burst sent a large piece of shrapnel right through Alex's lungs. The blast was so powerful that it broke through the small piece of metal plating on the side of his flak vest. For the next few seconds, Beans watched in horror as Alex went cold and became lifeless. Beans quickly got up and called in that Alex didn't make it. His lips were barely able to mouth the words, he was so disturbed. That's when Beans heard over the intercom Tommy's voice calling out saying,
"My turret is stuck, goddammit, my turret is stuck!"
Soon, Willie and Beans arrived at Tommy, and that's when Willie realized that the gear components of Tommy's turret had been damaged from flak. Stress fractures ran through the right side of the ball turret's gears, and there was nothing that Willie could do to get Tommy out of his turret manually. Every attempt only made the damage of the gears worse. Luckily, Tommy's turret was parallel with the bottom of the plane, and his guns were pointing towards the front of the bomber, so they could still land with him inside.
"Tommy, listen to me, okay? Your turret's beat to hell. You're gonna have to wait until we land back in England so they can cut you out,"
Willie said.
"What? No, fuck that! Get me out of this thing!"
Tommy yelled back over the intercom.
"Is there nothing else we can do?"
the boss asked.
"No, I can't manually move it. The tracking gears are covered in stress fractures and cracks. I'm afraid I'm gonna make it worse,"
Willie commented back.
"Roger that. Sit tight, Tommy,"
the boss called in.
"No, Jesus fucking Christ, no! Get me out of this goddamn thing!"
Tommy panicked.
"Tommy, calm down. You'll be fine down there,"
Jack yelled over the intercom.
"Yeah, Tommy. I won't let anything happen to you, I swear,"
Willie said, giving off some assurance. Tommy continued to argue, mostly out of his claustrophobic anxiety that was now plaguing him. As Jack went to reply to Tommy's cries for help, a flak shell exploded inches from Jack's position. The next thing he knew, he felt a sharp, burning sensation piercing his face. The feeling felt like 1,000 needles penetrating every inch of his head. Putting his hand in front of his face to try to figure out what was happening, he tried to open his eyes but found it painful and difficult. The boss looked over at Jack, who had his arms in front of his face, trying to shield himself, from the 150-mile-an-hour, negative-15-degree winds slamming into his face. Small pieces of plexiglass were all over the cockpit and all over Jack, several of them torn to Jack's face. The blast knocked out Jack's windshield, severely cracking the boss's windshield, and most of Jack's right window had been cracked and looked to be on the verge of shattering as well. That's when the boss noticed that their number 3 engine was hit and the propeller was spinning violently. The boss attempted to feather the engine, but it wasn't working. The engine was now spinning out of control and wasn't responding. The boss's first response was to signal the alarm to have the men bail out, but before he did, he punched the feathering button one last time on the number 3 engine and was astonished that it worked. While this was going on, the boss was unaware as to what was going on down the nose compartment.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. In fact, to give a shout out to those who are supporting this podcast, we want to thank Fernando, Reinhold, Benita, Kyle, and Cedric. Thank you guys so much for all your support and your helping this podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast. The Bull was hurting bad, and its number 3 engine was now dead. The boss threw the throttles upward to gain some airspeed, while Jack put on Willie's pair of goggles that he had stored in his bag. The Bull shuddered from the stress that the other 3 engines were putting on the airframe, as the boss gave the engines all the power he could. The Bull had fallen out of formation, but not by much. Captain Kidd was only 100 or so yards away from them, and the boss was sure he could keep up. With Jack's bloodshot eyes now covered with flag goggles, he asked what he could do to help the boss. The boss asked for Jack to take the controls while he messed with the engines. Jack grabbed onto the yoke, his hands were shaking as he did. His face was still cut up, and blood ran down from the small cuts on his cheeks next to his oxygen mask, forehead, and the sides of his head. At the moment, Jack could feel small pieces of plexiglass embedded into his skin. He didn't have the luxury of plucking them out with his fingers. He would have to wait until he returned home to do so. Over the next 3 minutes, the boss struggled to keep up with the formation, as flak still pounded the formation, and few were getting close to the Bull. In the back of the plane, Pally was absolutely terrified. He had no idea how they were going to make it back to England on just 3 engines. He had seen many planes come back with feathered engines, but at the same time, those planes hadn't taken as much damage as his plane, or so he thought. On the other hand, Willie felt confident that the Bull could get him and the rest of the crew back to England safely. They weren't losing gas or oil. The other 3 engines were working fine and pumping out enough thrust to keep the plane from stalling. Willie went into the cockpit to check on the boss to see if he could help him out in any way. Once he arrived, he noticed that the Bull's airspeed was dropping.
"I can't keep up with them,"
the boss called out.
"We have no other choice but to start descending. Gain some airspeed, that is, if we want to keep up with the group,"
Jack said.
"I agree with him, Bosch. We're going to be hitting the French coast here in less than 15 minutes, right?"
Willie asked.
"I believe so. Charlie, how long will it take us to hit the French coast?"
the boss asked. No response came.
"Charlie! Come in, Charlie!"
Still no response.
"Oliver?"
Jack called in, and also heard no answer. As the men called in for Charlie and Oliver, the flak ceased.
"Willie, go down there, find out what's going on,"
the boss said.
"Come on, Bosch,"
Willie said, heading down the hatch behind the cockpit and into the crawl space that led into the nose compartment.
The moment Willie arrived in the crawl space, he knew something was wrong. Willie was filled with a sense of horror and dread as he lowered himself into the crawl space. The first clue that something was horribly wrong was the trail of blood that led to his severed arm that was lying in the pathway. Willie looked up, trying to see into the nose compartment. He was struggling to make sense as to what he was seeing. Charlie's bloody corpse was left sitting in his navigator's desk, with his left arm missing. His left shoulder was blown apart, and the back of his head was dripping with blood since it had come in contact with the flak fragment. Willie forced himself to push through the small opening, which was somewhat blocked by Charlie's body. As Willie made his way into the nose compartment, he looked forward and saw Oliver's lifeless body hunched over the bomb site. A large series of flak fragment holes littered the right side of the nose compartment, and the right side navigator's window had been completely blown out from the explosion. Willie then arrived at Oliver and checked to see if he was still alive. He wasn't. Upon further examination, Oliver had a large wound that went through his back and exited out of his chest. The small fragment, which was no bigger than a quarter, went right through his heart, killing him instantly. What confused Willie was, Oliver had taken off his flak vest, and it was sitting right next to him. Willie, with repulsion and horror written on his face, he returned back to the cockpit and informed the boss and Jack of the news. The boss then informed the remaining members of the crew that they would have to find their own way home and hope that they wouldn't run into any German fighters. Forty minutes later, the bull was still following the path of the formation, which they were still able to see. The boss was able to keep the bull's airspeed at a high enough rate that the plane currently wasn't having to lose altitude in order to gain any airspeed. Looking down below, Pally watched as the French island of Guernsey passed by. He was now hopeful of their return, since they were now minutes away from being over the English Channel. But just as he was so sure of his newfound safety, it was crushed when he heard Beans calling over the intercom.
I see buggies coming in, 3 o'clock low. I think those are escorts passing by,
the boss said.
No, those are the friendlies,
Jack said, pointing to a group of fighters flying off the bull's 11 o'clock high.
Shit. Okay, no need to panic. We've got plenty of ammo and guns. Jack, can you man the chin turret or the cheek guns?
The boss asked.
Sure, I'm on it,
Jack said as he got out of his seat.
Okay, Tommy, how you doing down there?
The boss asked.
I'm just trying to look on the bright side. Could be a lot worse. I keep you stuck inside a metal ball, left hanging underneath a bomber that looks like it got into a fight with a shotgun.
Tommy sarcastically joked.
Ash the fighting spirit, Tommy,
Willie said.
Pally, Beans, you boys okay?
The boss asked.
Yeah,
was Beans' subtle response.
Pally?
The boss asked.
I'm all good,
Pally responded.
Okay, let's give them hell, boys,
the boss said as he waited for the fighters to arrive. The next several minutes were long and agonizing. The bogies turned out to be four squadrons of ME-109s, and the bull was far enough from the formation that the fighters didn't see them at first and went on to attack the formation. Once the little friends arrived and met the attacking German fighters, some of the 109s began heading back to line up their next attack. When they did, that's when the pilot saw the wounded bomber struggling. With the fighter's sudden change in direction, and with them now headed straight towards the bull, Jack, who had moved Oliver's lifeless body to the side, grabbed his chin turret controls and aimed his sights on the incoming fighters. Soon, Jack pushed in the trigger and sent hot lead in the fighter's direction. The three 109s diverted their attacks, and soon, Willie and Beans were firing upon them. One 109 zipped past the bull from the left side and was able to get past Willie's sights. Since Beans was on the right side of the waste compartment, he didn't see him either. The 109 flipped upside down and pulled a tight turn, putting Pally right in his sights. Since Pally didn't hear the fighter being called in, he was too busy looking off to his left at another 109 that was getting ready to make an attack on the bomber.
Seeing bullets ripping into the rudder and horizontal stabilizers, Pally swung his twin 50s in the 109's direction and began spraying bullets out. Pally was so scared he barely kept his eyes open to see what he was shooting at. The next thing he knew was, his finger let go of the trigger, and he was shocked to see that he was still alive. His entire gunner's position was shot up, but he was okay. Looking down, both barrels of his twin 50s were scorching red from the intense heat. But that wasn't the only thing that caught his attention. Just below the bull, smoke trailed from a 109 that was now being sent towards the English Channel.
I think I nailed one!
Pally called out with unbelief and excitement.
Good job, Pally. Now shoot down some more.
The boss joked.
Binge, Pally, you see those two trying to sneak up on you? 5 o'clock level?
Willie asked.
I see them. Come on, come on, come on.
Bean said, aiming his sights on the two 109s. Pally opened fire on the two planes, and again, one of them unloaded their ammunition into the bull's tail and wing. Bullets ripped into the bull's vertical stabilizer, rudder, horizontal stabilizer, elevators, and Pally's gun position. One 109 rolled over and dove downward, escaping Pally's line of fire. The other 109 continued its path as more bullets were sent in Pally's direction. The other 109 continued its path, and as more bullets were sent in Pally's direction, he let off one more burst of fire. Just as he was about to let go of his trigger, he saw the 109 explode, turning the monoplane into a cloud of flames and debris.
Pally, Jesus Christ, Pally!
Willie yelled over the intercom after seeing the explosion.
I'm fine, I'm fine. I think I got another one.
Pally called in.
Are you sure you're okay?
Jack asked.
I'm sure. We're all shot up back here, but I'm okay.
Pally replied. Then, a 109 attempted to come back around and attack the bull from its underside, since they didn't see Tommy's turret moving. Beans luckily saw the incoming fighter and began firing upon him. The 109 let off a short burst of fire before he dove away, and soon a P-51 came to the rescue and chased down the fighter. The next few minutes were agonizing as Jack and the rest of Loaded Bull watched as the formation continued to get slammed by attacking fighters. Within minutes, two B-17s would join the bull, as they too sustained heavy damage and couldn't keep up with the formation. One of them was a B-17 from the 447 Bombardment Group, and the other was from the 96th Bombardment Group. Together, the three planes headed for England, where the B-17 from the 96th would ditch into the channel, and the other plane would make an emergency landing at an RAF field in Southampton. Loaded Bull safely made it back to Thurlow at close to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The boss and Jack both struggled to get the wounded bomber down onto the runway. Their fear was that if the landing gear failed, or if they were to crash land, Tommy, who was still stuck in his ball turret, would be crushed to death as a result. Luckily, that didn't happen. The bull landed safely and rolled back onto its hard stand with only a minor difficulty. As soon as the boss cut the engines, the men all quickly exited the blood-stained, battle-worn airplane and hurled themselves onto the cold concrete hard stand. Beans exited through the waste compartment, and soon, Pally did the same. When Pally saw the carnage done to both Cecil and Alex, he thought that he was experiencing a nightmare. There's no way that was real, he kept telling himself. Within minutes of the men exiting the plane, grounds crewmen arrived at the bull and began forcing the back hatch of the ball turret open, and like a yolk falling from an eggshell, Tommy fell onto the concrete floor, and he couldn't believe that he was still alive. His eyes were bloodshot red from his fear-driven tears, and his face lacked any emotion other than exhaustion. The boss, Jack, Willie, Tommy, Beans, and Pally all came together and embraced one another in silence, feeling that they had cheated death together and were somehow bonded together because of it. After the debriefing, the boss and the others were greeted by Rosie and Andy, who by beholding their crew members covered in blood, flesh, sweat, smoke, debris, and filth, were shocked and horrified. The 300th Bombardment Group was one of the lucky groups that day on the mission to Brest, for they did not lose a single plane. 8 airmen were killed during the mission, and 5 more were wounded. Stinker Tinker lost both their top turret gunner and their tail gunner to flak, and Cap'n Kids lost their radio man to fighters during their last fighter attack.
Desperate Journey and Bad Penny returned without a single dent, scratch, or mark, and one gunner from Bad Penny even claimed to shoot down a fighter. Pally would soon be awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for his bravery and his two fighter kills. This achievement made Pally one of the most popular gunners in the 300th. That night, the enlisted men that were among the 530th Squadron threw a party for Pally and the men of the Bull. However, Pally and Beans both left early to return back to their huts to get some sleep. They returned to their beds drunk, tired, shell-shocked, and worst of all, deeply disheartened. Pally could have cared less about his two fighter kills. He was so worn out that he didn't have the mental, physical, or emotional capacity to hold a normal conversation, let alone recount the events of the day to a bunch of rookie, peach-faced gunners. Beans felt the same way. He and Pally returned to their huts in complete silence. Beans kept seeing Alex's face every time he blinked. He could still smell the odor that was coming from Cecil's exploded body. The event was so horrific and so disturbing that Beans, for the first time in his life, questioned the purpose and meaning of his own life. How on earth was he supposed to keep pressing forward when he knew that he was going to end up like Cecil, Alex, or even Al? What was the purpose of all of this, he thought to himself. What was the point of all this grotesqueness and this wickedness? How was any of this justifiable in God's eyes? As Beans pondered this, he laid down in his bed, where he would remain for the next 24 hours, leaving the others and his crew to wonder if Beans was going to mentally be okay. Not knowing what else to do, they gave their friend and fellow airmen some space and some time. In the meantime, the boss and Jack hung around their groups of buddies and kept quiet, refusing to speak of the events that occurred on April 6th, since they would give anything to never remember it again. The men all dealt with their traumas in their own unique ways, and nobody bothered them for how they handled it. Men like Ronnie, Mickey, Brolin, O'Brien, Sheila, and Coca understood this, for they had had a handful of missions that were just like this, and knew the process of coming to terms with the horrors of combat. On the contrary, men like Parnell, Hillhouse, and Texas were unable to truly sympathize with men like the boss and Jack, for they hadn't experienced the level of hell that they've had to endure so far. What pained men like Jack more than anything was, he knew every time he looked at Parnell's face, that his buddies would soon have to face the same horrors of combat as he had. He had no idea how they would handle it, and quite frankly, he didn't know how he was going to either. Thank you for listening to episode 19 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canto 34 Studios, a DIY project helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies of Europe in World War II. I hope we do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 20 of Snafu, The Favor.